ॐ भक्ताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिताम् पुराणमुनिना मन्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अहं भक्त्वामनुसन्धामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वेषिणी.
On page 122 for the red book.
Trividyamam somapakutapaha. Trividyamam somapakutapaha. Yajnairishtva swarbhikatim pratyante. Yajnairishtva swarbhikatim pratyante. Te punyamasaja surendra lokam. Te punyamasaja surendra lokam. Ashnanti divyan divideva bhogan. Ashnanti divyan divideva bhogan. Trividya. Actually, it's trividyaha. Mom. Somapaha. Putapapaha yajnyahi ishtva swargagatim pratyante te punyam asadya surendra lokam ashnanti divyan divi deva bhogan. Okay, this next two verses are Bhagavan is now talking about the different types of people who seek me, in a sense. He's talking about now the what we call the karmatas. Karmatas are the ones who are devoted to the first portion of the Vedas, the karmakanda, and who are held within the Vedic Dharma. So they're dharmis, but they're also kamis. Dharmis means, you know, dharmin means dharma. The dharma is, you know, the golden rule, doing your duties, following the Vedic Dharma, those do's and don'ts, you know, being committed to the do's and don'ts of dharma, really. So that's a very simple definition of dharma. Dharmin means the one who has dharma, the one who follows dharma, that in affects is very common. So similarly, kama means a desire. Kamin, a kami, is one who has desires. Kama itself, the word kama, as we'll see a little bit, the word kama itself means a desire. It also means an object of desire, right? And so a kama can be the desire, one who has the desire, or the object of desire. Or we can say kamin. Kamin means one who is a kami, one who has the desire. So just in Sanskrit. So here, it starts out with trividyaha. Those people who are committed to the three Vedas. Here we have the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda. There's also the Atharva Veda, but initially there were these three. The Atharva Veda is a little different of the four Vedas. The Atharva Veda is more a collection of incantations, things like that, where the first three Vedas...
Incantations,
different prayers, like say if you were to say a certain mantra 500,000 times, and that particular mantra, you know, was something to ward off snake bites. Those type of mantras and other things like that are collected in the Atharva Veda. It is more than that, but it's more of a collection of mantras that are used for particular purposes, you know, to give you particular siddhis over certain things. And so So here, anyway, the three Vedas are what are highlighted here, the Rig, Yajur, and Sama, because these three Vedas really are focused on kind of Vedic life and the karma, and the and what we call the karmas being the rituals, the karmas and the dharmas. The word karma also, that's something to understand. The word karma comes from the root kri, to do. So we can think of karma as just an action, like you can say karma as an action, or you can use it as, that's my karma. If you say, that's my karma, that's the result of my action. If you say, that's my karma, you know, that you're saying, I did this action and now I'm reaping the results. So if I say, this is my karma, it means my punya or papa. Punya means the positive results of actions. I'm reaping the positive results of my action. That's punya. Papa is I'm reaping the negative results of my action. So we can even say things like punya papa karmas. If I say something's a punya karma, that means that action that I did results in the subtle effect that we call punya that will result later in a positive result. Is your husband here? Is your husband here?
No.
Oh, okay. Because you can use that thing. But, you know, so you'd be more comfortable.
Am I a chair?
No, that's okay.
Okay. So here, dharma, the word dharma, also is used for karma. But here, then, if the dharma is being used for karma, we're meaning actions that are that follow the Vedic dharma. In other words, the actions that are positive actions that are sanctioned by the Vedas, those are dharmic actions. The actions, there's also a number of actions to avoid, those are also dharmic actions. See what I mean? And so sometimes dharma, is when we say it's your dharma, that has to do with the actions that you choose to do that are in line with the Vedic culture and your place in it at that particular time. So anyway, this comes up later. So here, Trividyaha, those people who are contained within the three Vedas and have knowledge of all three Vedas. That's unusual. Most people are born into a family and they have one Veda, you know, which holds that family, one Rishi, one Veda. But there are also pujaris and the different priests who will learn all three Vedas. They can chant all three Vedas. They can, some can even not only chant the three Vedas, some even know what it means what they're chanting. And really, I mean, we can learn, we learn the chants, then we learn what the chants mean. You also learn the chants, and then you learn how to apply those chants to rituals, and then you can also go a step deeper into really, you really understand the meaning of what you're chanting. So it's just more and more depth of expertise. But a person who's a tri-vidya means that person has knowledge, understanding of all three Vedas. They can at least chant all three Vedas. So that's quite a feat. So it says, those people, the people who are tri-vidya, they have knowledge of all three Vedas. Also, somapaha, people who, literally somapaha means those people who can have drunk the soma, you know? People who have drunk the soma means this. It's not that just they're soma drinkers. It's that there's a ritual called the soma yaga, and it's a complex ritual. It's called the soma yaga, and it will lead to, the result of the soma yaga is a swargaloka, is gaining a heaven world. And so as part of this soma yaga, the prasad of the soma yaga, after the soma, which is a drink from a vine in India, a particular vine in India. So that soma is offered to the deity, and what is left over is drunk as prasad at the end of the ritual. So really, when you say the soma paha, it means those people who have participated in the soma yaga, this particular ritual which leads to swargaloka, to those people. Then putapa paha. Those peoples whose papas, papa karmas, means the negative karmas that cause pain, have been, that go against the dharma, those papa karmas have been purified. Bhuta means purified. But hear what they mean, not purified absolutely in terms of self-knowledge or the nature of the self, and not even in reference to karma yoga. It's peoples whose papa karmas are purified by their being contained within the Vedic life, doing the nitya and naimittika karmas. The naimittika karmas are the nitya karmas are the karmas, the rituals and the different austerities that you're enjoined to do on a daily basis, and the naimittika karmas are the karmas that you do on an occasional basis. And then the prayaschitta karmas are karmas you do if, say, you've done something that goes against the Dharma. You can do a prayaschitta karma to neutralize it, you know. There's also daily karmas that are expected of you to do. And even the kamya karmas. There's nothing, kamya karmas means the karmas that are done in order to fill a desire. Like, say, I want to go to Swargaloka, I want to go to heaven world. I can do kamya karmas that are in the Vedas that will help me to get to that world. Or say, my family, you know, I'm not able to have a child. You know, there's kamya karmas, and I desire, in our family, we want to have children, but we're not able to have any children. There's kamya karmas, means karmas done for a certain desire, to fulfill a certain desire. Those are done and prescribed by the Vedas. There's nothing adharmic, or nothing, there's no papa in that at all. I can do all kinds of kamya karmas because I'm not a mumukshu. It's not like I'm seeking liberation. I'm seeking to gain to gain in an appropriate way, you know, the things that I desire. That's all taken place, that's all covered beautifully in the first portion of the Vedas. So what he's saying here is that a person who's contained within the Vedas and living a Vedic life, that person, their papas have been, you know, neutralized for the most part, because you're living a life where you avoid the papa karmas, and you also are performing actions that are meant to neutralize those papa karmas. So that's a puttapapaha. Then he says, for these type of people, yajnyahi ishtwa. Ishtwa means invoking me, praying to me, you know, through the yajnas, through these rituals. Mam means me, so it says, mam yajnyahi ishtwa. Invoking me, praying to me, you know, through these yajnas, through all of the rituals that are enjoined in that Vedic life, he says, swargagatim pratyante, invoking me, they pray for, they desire swargaloka. They desire going to swarga. Now, so what we're talking about here is not a mumukshu, not a person who has recognize that all of the different ends that are reached are only temporary ends. They're not in that realm at all. For these people, though, they're contained within the Vedas, living a Vedic life, living a dharmic life, doing the rituals, worshipping me, means Ishwara, worshipping me as the Lord, you know, in order to get to Swargaloka, where everything is good. Swargaloka means heaven. I go to this heaven world, everything, as long as I'm there, everything is wonderful. In Swamiji's commentary said, you know, he said, I talked a tiny bit about this last week, but I didn't quite get the gist of it. He said, in Swargaloka, you don't have to eat or drink. You just have to see it. You simply have to see it. And in the seeing of it itself is the pleasure. Right? And so in Swargaloka, what they say in that world, as long as you're there, this is the part that the ones who desire Swargaloka forget about, like all of us who have not realized this problem, any achievement is time-bound. That they hasn't quite sunk in. So Swamiji sometimes has joked about this, like, say like this, the Swargaloka lasts for a really long time. Like, this life is only maybe 80, 90 years. If you, you know, and say you have 80, 90 really good years, but then it's over. So you start becoming aware of your mortality, you know, at the halfway mark. You know, you start becoming aware of it. But in Swargaloka, you can live for thousands upon thousands of years and you don't age, you don't get old, you know. And so say you've just arrived. Just arrived, and you know, you've got 5,000 years at least. So that's going to be a long time before you have to deal with the mortality issue. It coming to an end and having to drop back into what we call Martyaloka. We'll see in the next verse. But the problem is that at some point, you do arrive there. You do arrive there, and then the time starts ticking. Mm. That's the idea. Because anything, this is more the next verse, but this is the problem with the Swargaloka. Just like any achievement, you know, it's gained in time. It's gained through limited effort, and gives limited result. That's the problem. Takes place in time, limited effort, produces, even if it's a great effort, it's a great limited effort, and the great limited effort produces a great limited result. Therefore, time-bound. So these heaven worlds are great, but they don't last. Anyway, we're not looking at that in this verse, so not exactly. This verse is just the positive part of it. So he says, they pray for Swargaloka, worshipping me, you know, through the yajnas, these people who are totally devout and held within the Vedic culture. And he says, te punyam asadya, then having attained what it means, having attained this punyam surendra lokam, this world, this loka, this world of Indra, because Indra is the lord of the lord of the lokas. So the Surendra Loka is a good Swarga Loka, and it's a Punya Loka. So that Punya means Punya Lokam. That Swarga Loka, that Indra Loka, is a Punya Bhumi. You need a tremendous amount of Punya to get there. Okay, to this Loka where Indra as a Devata is the Lord. So you need a tremendous amount of Punya to get there. It's a Punya Bhumi. So now they, you know, having reached this Punya Bhumi, then what? Ashnanti, they enjoy Divi in heaven, Divyan Deva Bhogan, heavenly enjoyments of the gods. Bhoga means enjoyment. Deva means enjoyments that the gods, the devatas, will enjoy. And they are all heavenly. They're not like here, you know. The things that we enjoy here have a negative side to them. You know, like for instance, you know, the cup half full, or when you, should I bring my Cherry Garcia in?
Sure.
When you have your Cherry Garcia,
it's gone.
What happens as you enjoy it is that it goes away. You know, it goes away. Everything is limited. If you eat too much, you get full, you know? If you exercise too much, you get tired and stiff the next day. So everything has, you know, both sides to it. You know, we have joy, but the joy also is accompanied with pain. Sukha is accompanied with dukkha. Everything has a has a loss. But in Swargaloka, as long as you're there, that's not the situation. In fact, one enjoyment, if it is replaced by another enjoyment, by another enjoyment, by another enjoyment. And you think, well, maybe would I get tired of the enjoyments? No, because if you're getting tired of it, it's replaced by something that you're not tired of. See what I mean? There's no dukkha in Swarga. That's how they talk about it. And so you can think, this is where I want to go. This is where I want to go, where I don't have to worry or think about the suffering of myself or others, for that matter. Where the suffering is not there. Where I'm in just a state where I can relax and enjoy myself and I don't have to worry about it. So let me go there. Let me really work for it. It's hard to get to Swargaloka. You have to live a dharmic, Vedic life, but there's also all kinds of rituals and upasanas that you can do. In other parts of the Vedas, they talk about kind of the negative side of all the work that it takes to get up there. Now, one of the things that they talk about is that with all of these Vedic rituals, they have, you know, you have to, it's always done in a fire. There's always a fire that's built within kind of a little brick fire
surround.
Yeah, that surrounds it. And then you'll sit there and you're continually chanting and offering ghee into the fire. And also you're offering bananas and mangoes and fruits. And the smoke is usually intense. So when, so they talk about that. They talk about the smoke. So I didn't really understand until on my 60th birthday, I had a special ritual done, and it was wonderful. I really wanted to, it's very sacred to have this ritual done on your 60th, around your 60th birthday. So I had it done. And the ritual lasts for maybe 2.5 hours. And so I was sitting there right in front of the fire, and I would be offering, and the pujari would be offering, you know, and we'd be, they'd chant. Sometimes I would have to chant. So I was sitting there along with some of the, you know, people that were close to me that were sitting around. And the smoke, the smoke was so much that I understood, I remembered the verse in this Gita. It was, and that ritual was very important to me, and I was able to do it for that 2.5 hours. I was able to do it, but it was literally very difficult to breathe. It was very difficult to breathe or to even open your eyes for much of the time, you know. And then when it was done, and, you know, we went down, and then I had to go and take a shower and all of that. That was part of it. And then, you know, they offer something else. And so all of the clothes that I wore and even my shawl were finished forever. They were finished forever because of the smoke.
Lingering.
At the lingering smoke. And so this is what's called it's the tapas. There's a tapas involved in these rituals that they talk about, that they actually talk about. And I understood after, you know, because I have been to several of them, but I could come and go, you know, and if it was smoky, that was fine. I didn't think about it because I could just leave. It didn't make any difference at all. You know, and so I'd be there for 10 or 15 minutes, or maybe I'd stay for 20 minutes. But this wasn't like that. This was sitting right there for the whole time, as all of the pujaris did, and they're totally used to it. They do. And so and there's places in the Gita where they talk about kind of what that means to, you know, all of the smoke, having to sit amidst all of that smoke as a kind of a tapas, or the difficult side of it. So anyway... But here, so there's a lot of work to getting up there. It's not an easy thing, and that's also talked about a lot. But once you get there, once you're there, there's no illness, there's no old age, you know, no lacking, your sense organs don't become dim, all of these type of things. So it's the best that you could possibly imagine within duality, you know. The only thing is that you have to come back, you know, to this. That's the only little problem. So here, he just paints the picture saying these people who live a devoted life within the Vedic culture, right, they worship me with all of these rituals and yajnas, following the Dharma of the Vedas, and they do it in order to, with a desire to achieve swarga. And so then, having achieved it, because they have done all of the karmas that would get you there, having achieved it, having gone to Swarga Loka, which is this Punya Bhumi, then they attain all of these heavenly enjoyments that the devas enjoy. Okay? So, then what? Let's go to the next verse.
Can I ask you a question about that one? On Surendra Lokam?
Surendra.
Sura
Indra. It just means the heaven world of Indra.
Okay.
Yeah. It's
Sura is heaven.
Yeah. It's just of Indra. Indra's heaven world.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all it is, Sura. Te tam bhutva swargalokam vishalam. Te tam bhutva swargalokam vishalam. Kshine punye marchalokam vishanti. Kshine punye marchalokam vishanti. Evam trahi dharmam anuprapapannaha. Evam trahi dharmam anuprapapannaha. Gatagatam kama kama lapante. Gatagatam kama kama lapante. Te tam bhuktva swadagat lokam vishalam kshine punye marchalokam vishanti evam trayi dharmam anu prapannaha gata agatam kama kamaha labante. Here it says, so these people, they, who have gone to the Swargaloka, they, tam bhuktva Swargalokam vishalam, they, those people, who have worked for this, they get there, then they, bhuktva, having enjoyed tam that, Swargalokam, which is vast, vishalam, it's vast, huge, so they, having enjoyed that vast, he has vistirnam. It means it spreads out everywhere, this vast, huge swargaloka. So they, having enjoyed that vast swargaloka, kshine punye, when their punya runs out. Kshine means it to be destroyed. When the punya, but it has the idea of when it runs out. Mm-hmm. When the punya is finished, you know, is destroyed, and it's destroyed by time. Like every moment of punya, everything, every action that's a result of the punya, as that takes place, that punya is gone. So you only have, you know, a basket of punya, right? So that basket, you know, of positive results and experiences is going to run out one at a time, right? And just a little aside here to make you understand this. It's true for the negatives also. For the papas. The papas also, every time that you experience a papa karma, it's gone. Once you've experienced it, it's gone. And so when they say in this life, the human life, according to the Vedic tradition, is 50% punya, 50% papa. And so if something bad, this is kind of the Hindu mind, if something really bad happens, you know, you'll say, okay, that papa's over. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in your astrology chart, it will say, this is a dangerous time. This is a difficult time. Now, you'll look at other places in the astrology chart, it'll say, these are really auspicious times for you. This is a good time to start something, you know. But this is a time you have to be very careful. Don't travel very much. Watch your step. They'll say all of that type of thing, you know. So once Swamiji was in one of those negative aspects, and the astrologers were all really worried, you know, that this was maybe 15 years ago, it's a long time ago, but it took place at Sailors, when he was in Sailorsburg, teaching at the ashram there. There was this bad patch, and it lasted for a few months, and so everybody was always very, very careful, and, we're driving out all... careful, because it was a very dangerous, life-threatening patch, you know. And so once Swamiji was walking, it was snow, it was in the middle of winter, you know, so very smooth snow, and there's a lot of ice, too, on the pathway, and right outside of his kutir, you know, there's that wooden porch, and that wooden porch gets icy. And then also there's the asphalt little path that goes right off the wooden porch. In that area, it can get really icy. You have to be very careful. So they're always kind of trying to hold him and make sure he's not slip or slide or anything. And so here he is walking right off the porch there, and he slips and falls off the edge of the porch, you know, and bangs his hip and hurts his hip. And then he gets up and makes his way to the lecture hall, you know, because, he hurt himself. He makes his way. Everybody's happy. This was the papa. This is all it was. All the prayers, all of the chants, all of the, you know, rituals, and everything has been going on, you know, to try to make the...
Mitigate
it, you know. And so, Swamiji, something happened. It hurt his hip. it was bad. Swamiji fell, and I was, you know, it was really something. He's perfectly okay. So everybody was feeling so relieved. Like, so that papa, that was, that must have been the papa karma. It's gone. So, yeah. That's the basket of papas being neutralized. So I even think that way, if something's, you know, difficult patch passes, good. That one's gone. That's a very kind of Indian way of thinking. Okay, so now, the thing is, when everything's going well, you're also exhausting your papa, or your punya. When everything's going well, you're exhausting your punya, mm-hmm. you know? And so here, it's more obvious up there, you know, because of the long time, you know, and you just get so used to it, you know? Until maybe at the end you start becoming... She needs Peter.
Papa Peter.
Yeah, that's Peter's punya.
This is the salmon cubes.
I have to tell a little thing about the meditation. Okay, so anyway. So Kshine Punya. When these papas are just systematically being destroyed, being exhausted, you know, being destroyed, being exhausted, then what? Martyalokam Vishanti. They enter into Martyaloka, the loka where there is death. Martyaloka means this bhumi, this loka, where there's birth and death. So having exhausted, they enjoy all of the, they enjoy being in the Swarga Loka, right? But enjoying it, as they enjoy it, they exhaust the punya. When the punya is exhausted, then they enter into, back into this Martyaloka. They drop back into it.
Right? Does that mean they die?
They don't die, apparently. I don't know the details of that, but it's as though they come to an end. Do you know, it's kind of like in the dream world, you mm-hmm. can... It's very unusual, actually, to actually experience a death in the dream world, even though some people have experienced dying in the dream world, and then you experience the death and realize this is all within the dream. You die in the dream, but then you realize that I died in the dream and I'm not dead. Is anybody? It's a very unusual type of dream. It's not common. What's the most common is that you're in the dream world, mm-hmm. and then you're not. That's, yeah. So it's more like that. Death is apparently not experiencing that world. But this is kind of not the scope of Vedanta. This is the scope of the Karmakanda. The scope of Vedanta is where those people have realized that they're going to, that the punya does come to an end, the papa comes to an end, the punya comes to an end, absolutely everything comes to an end. So is there anything that doesn't? That's the mumukshu.
And you can't be a mumukshu and be a Svargaloka?
Oh, you can. It actually,
oh, can?
That's a very good question. let me explain that. There are different levels of Svargaloka. The top, highest level, and I don't have an endless depth of knowledge in this particular area, but just let me give you what I do have. In the Brahmaloka, which is the very highest loka, and in this loka, this world, it's these two lokas alone where there that the mind is able to gain self-knowledge. It's only in these two lokas. In all of the other lokas, the mind is that kartritvam, or that type of desire, is not there. There's just it's called a bhoktritvam, where they're just enjoying means experiencing the world, like in the dream, for instance. You're just experiencing the world. You're not accruing karma. In this plane, they're accruing karma. And so accruing punya and papa. And in this plane, you can gain self-knowledge. This is just according to the kind of the Vedic tradition or Vedic, what they say in the Vedas. So you can just take it as myth or take it as a reality, whatever you want. This is what they say. So in this plane, you gain self-knowledge, and in Brahmaloka, you gain self-knowledge. If you gain self-knowledge in Brahmaloka, in the highest loka, then when this creation comes unmanifest, goes into its unmanifest condition, because the creation is viewed as cyclical, manifest goes into unmanifest, manifest goes into unmanifest, when it goes into unmanifest condition, then at that time you are liberated. You're liberated while living also in the Brahmaloka, but you don't take another birth. You don't ever experience any type of death at all. The jiva will live until the very end of the kalpa. But at the end of the kalpa, when the world, in the end of the time period of the manifestation of the world, when it comes into unmanifest condition, that jiva is totally released. Like for you, if you have self-knowledge, when the prarabdha karma runs out, there's no more birth for you. So for a person who is liberated in the Brahmaloka, when the karma runs out, when the karma of the whole creation runs out, means goes into unmanifest condition, there's no more birth for you because you have self-knowledge.
Same knowledge and same Upanishads?
Same knowledge, same Upanishads. There's not two different knowledges. That's why Swamiji will sometimes joke, you work so hard to get to Brahmaloka, you know, you get so much smoke in your eyes, you know, so much work to get to Brahmaloka, so that then you can be taught. He'll make a joke and say, so for same Mumukshu, I want to be taught by Brahmaji, you know, which is Brahmaji is just the embodiment of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, an embodiment of Ishwara as Brahmaji in Brahmaloka. Mm. I want to be taught by Brahmaji. I want to be taught this knowledge by Brahmaji. You know? But the knowledge that you're being taught by Brahmaji is the same knowledge you're being taught by your teacher here. So it's kind of a circuitous route. You know? I want to first let me go to Brahmaji. Let me go to Brahmaloka. Let me experience that heaven world. And then be taught directly by Brahmaji. Be taught what? This knowledge that I'm teaching you here right now. So that's going to be a joke. He tells that joke very well. Okay. So now he says, Kshine punye marchalokam vishanti. They all come back to this world. And then he says, evam trayid dharmam anuprapannaha. Those who are following the dharma of these three Vedas, that's what they mean by trayi dharma, the dharma, following all of the karmas in that Vedic life. Those who are following that Vedic dharma in this manner, he says, anuprapannaha, means those who have followed it. What about them? Gata agatam kama kamaha. Those people who he calls kama kamahas, those people who are desirous. They are people who are desiring kamas. They're desiring objects of desire. Everybody has desires. They have different objects of desires. So those people have their own, each person has their own specific desire. So they're a desirer of desired objects. But if I asked each of you, what are your desires? Well, I desire this, and I desire this, and I desire this. Those are all kamas. This is one kama I have, this is another kama I have, this is another kama I have. So I'm a desirer of this desired object, So he says, so all of these people, all of these kama kamahas, these desirers of desired objects, what happens to them? He says, they obtain gata agatam. They obtain coming and going. They gain coming and going. Gata means they go, agata means they come. Or actually it's agata. Agata means come. So it's gata, agata. They go someplace, then they come back from it. They go and they come and they go and they come and they go and they come. That is samsara. Mm. Means there's no stopping place at all. Everything. Sometimes we say the samsara, the chakra, you know. I'm caught in the wheel of samsara because there's no landing place. Any state that you go to Swargaloka, come back from Swargaloka. Go to Swargaloka, go to this heaven world, come back here. Go to that heaven world, come back. Go to that Naraka, hell worlds also, heaven worlds and hell worlds, all determined by your punya and papa karmas. You go there and come back, go there and come back. That's the life for somebody who's living. Now he's not dealing with hell worlds because he's talking about trividya, you know, the people who are really living a dharmic life, you know, a dharmic life, not accruing papa, neutralizing papa. Now, as Swamiji will say here, the people who, there are some saris, they're not mumukshus, but they're living this dharmic life, trying to fulfill their desires, you know. Because those people are not accruing papa, they enjoy shanti. Right? It's really a dharma and papa that creates a shanti. A shanti means, you know, an agitated or upset mind. And a mind that has shanti is capable of reflection. So it is that type of mind that's really required in order to move into the mumukshutvam. Mm. You know, where you start questioning your experience. You know, like say you're living a very dharmic life and have a lot of peace in your life, but no matter how much peace you have, everything that you love comes to everything and everyone that you love comes to an end. And so there's built into life, even if you're a dharmi, suffering. And your own life comes to an end also. You know, I remember Swamiji once when we were Sailorsburg, and we were in the cafeteria. You know, there's that kind of little annex to the cafeteria, and it had some pictures of Swamiji on the wall when Swamiji was about 40, so 45 or so. And actually, the pictures that he was pointing to were pictures that we had used here to put on some events. So then, what was this? So that was a long time ago. That was almost 40 years ago. And so he looked, and he was with some of us who had known him for many years, and he looked and he said, "Do you remember? I remember that guy."
Meaning him?
Yeah. Oh. "Hey, remember that guy? I'd like to be that guy." Healthy, strong body, you know, not having to deal with the problems of age. And he just laughed. But really, you know, I don't think old age is very much fun. Mm-hmm. My mom said to me once, "Honey, it's no fun to get old." She was old. It's no fun to get old, you know. There's not much you can do about it. But when he said that, you know, he was laughing and joking about it. But there's truth in it. Mm-hmm. You know, remember that guy? I'd like to be that guy again. So anyway, so the point, he's going to go on now to the people who have recognized, but it's interesting that Krishna spent like two verses talking about a person who is really living the Vedic culture. Because say this Bhagavad Gita was written, you know, within the Vedic culture. And so even though you're doing everything perfectly, you know, what that gets you to is another stage of realization. That no matter how perfectly I do everything, you know, no matter how dharmic I am, you know, no matter how many heaven worlds I go to, I'm still caught, you know, within this cycle of samsara. There's no release for me from that. And that's why they have the second part of the Vedas. The first part of the Vedas, the Karma Kanda, is to give a person relative shanti, you know, as much relative peace as you can get in a given life by following dharma, you know, by understanding dharma and adharma, by living a dharmic life. You get relative shanti, but it's not absolute shanti. Relative shanti means it comes to an end. Why are you looking at me like that? You know what I mean by relative shanti? It means that the mind has peace, but it's not absolute. There's no absolute peace.
We'll talk about all this.
Okay. There's no absolute peace. It means any peace that you have is subject to change and subject to coming to an end. That is the nature of the creation. We can't get away from that. So what if you say, is there anything, you know, that is not relative, that's absolute, where I can relax? You know, is there anything? Well, no. There is nothing within samsara. As long as that kartritva, bhoktritva is there, that doership and enjoyership means there's duality, right? There is no space where you can just say, all right, all is well with me, and just relax there. Because the instant you say that, that moment's gone. So there's no coming to any type, there's no coming to any type of stable position. And you can say, it's all right with me to not come to any type of stable position. But really, that's only true if you're speaking from a stable position. Mm-hmm. You know? It's like, it's all right with me that the world is subject to birth and death and change. It's all right with me that I both enjoy happiness and suffering. You know? But if I'm the one that's suffering, at that time, it's not all right with me. When I'm actually suffering, what I want is to get out of that suffering. You know, you won't sit in a situation of suffering and saying, this is fine, I'll just stay here. You know? So is there something, some place, some reality, is there something for me to discover that is actually free from suffering? A place where I can relax and not be like a drowning man. Like the drowning man, when they're up getting some air, they can breathe and feel so relieved until they're pulled back down again. Then they're pushed up, and then they're pulled back, and then they're pushed up, and then pulled back. After a while, you don't feel like being pushed up anymore. If you know it's only going to last for a few seconds, so you can be pulled back down again. So then you say, is there anything, is there any way off this samsara chakra, this wheel of samsara? And what is that? That's the state of a mumukshu, the one who desires liberation. You know? And so that's the next few verses.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just leave you with a good, you know, the Vaidika. The person is living a Vedic life, and this is the best you can get, but it's not good enough. Yeah. In the end, it's not good enough. Let's stop there. Keep in it.
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
I saw a very beautiful photograph from the Ajanta Caves, so that's about 1,500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it has in this one painting, wall painting on the cave, it has Svarga Loka there.
Yeah.
And it has Lord Buddha in Svarga Loka teaching all of his students in front of him.
Yeah.
It was so sweet to see. You know? And then there was one that where he was teaching in the forest here. Mm-hmm. So it was the same teaching.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just really impressive.
Could you say something about the visions of the different Upanishads in contrast to the Gita, and how much the different visions of the other Upanishads are needed to complement the Gita, or because it's also said the Gita is the vision in its own and it's complete, and could you just kind of...
Yeah, what they say is that the Bhagavad Gita, which takes place right in the middle, in the center of the Mahabharata, makes the whole everything that's held in the Upanishads accessible to us, to everybody. And so that everybody should have a Gita. They should all have a Gita because it makes it so accessible. And it's right in line with the Upanishads to the extent that it itself is considered praised as an Upanishad.
Mm.
And so the Upanishads are very... Every Upanishad is quite terse, where the Gita expands. It'll take the subject that it wants to teach you and give you several verses you know, on even a chapter on a whole topic, and makes it much easier, much more accessible, even though Swamiji says it's very difficult to teach. You really have to understand the Gita to teach it. But if you understand it, it makes it so accessible to the student. But the vision of the Gita is what is contained in all of the Upanishads. Now, all of the Upanishads, there's many different Upanishads, but each one has the same vision. The same vision is the Mahavakya, that thou art, or aham brahmasmi, that thou art, you are, you know, that thou art, you are that, you know, the ten, aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, you know, consciousness is Brahman. So there's different, many different Mahavakyas. Every Upanishad is centered on these Mahavakyas. But they will highlight different aspects, like maybe more, one is highlighting more Ishwara, one is more from the standpoint of the Jiva, one is more from the standpoint of just the non-dual, like the Mandukya Upanishad. You know, one is looking at it more from more of a Vedic culture, like the Chandogya has so many upasanas, so many things about Vedic life and ritual. You know, and so, but they'll all be taking you to the same place. You know, and even for us, when we have to kind of cover all of the different prakriyas that are highlighted in the different, prakriyas means teaching methodologies that are highlighted in the different Vedas, because in the different Upanishads, because those are areas in your mind also where you can have certain doubts. You know, like I could talk all about the nature of the Jiva, but then I'm not putting any emphasis on Ishwara. I could talk all about Ishwara, but no emphasis on the Jiva. You know, I could talk about the identity between the Jiva and Ishwara, but then I haven't really gone thoroughly into the Jiva or into Ishwara. I'm just talking about the identity. Or I could talk about non-duality, but then non-duality, if that's not enough, unless I understand it thoroughly within this dual world. Like, for instance, if we talk about the surrender of the Jiva, you know, we've talked about surrender. The Jiva has to... Who does the Jiva surrender to? Ishwara. Mm-hmm. Right? Not to Brahman. The Jiva surrenders to Ishwara, where I realize that this body, mind, sense organs is like a cell in the body. That this is part of the whole. So otherwise, how can this Jiva give itself over to Ishwara, that kartritvam, that doership and enjoyership has to stay there? I have to make my own way, even though everything's non-dual still. I have to handle this whole thing, you know. But that's not true. But to understand that, I can't see this as an inert being. I have to see this as Ishwara, as a conscious being, of which I am a part. That means I'm part of a greater story. You know, that the laws in the story that are true to the whole include me. And so then I can watch my life take place and respond and engage in it, but I don't feel like I'm the one who has carved out this life, you know, like a carving out a pathway. There's a pathway and I have to decide which way I'm going to go. And until I decide, you know, there's nothing's been written. So it's all up to me. That's a big burden. But what if you see yourself as part of a story, almost part of a play, and you then are responding and engaging in this play, where the universe is a conscious being, it's not an inert being. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different...
And Carol, for Gyani, for that, in terms of Ishwara, does it become more like Ishwara's doing this, even doing this, you know, doing the activity through the body, through a particular, you know, like your own body mind sort of thing?
Yeah.
Right.
So do you mean, just to complete this?
Yeah. What was the question? I wasn't clear what she asked.
Say yes to that and then say, well, there's still free will and all of that stuff, but even the free will is Ishwara. Mm-hmm. You see, there's nothing outside of Brahman. This is mitya. And so even when you say that there's free will, that free will is Ishwara. You know, choice is Ishwara. And choice, say if we want to break it down, there's, we make it like this so it's more kind of understandable. that there's the prarabdha karma that's caused you to take this birth, and that's kind of the unfolding of you. You have dropped into this particular birth, you know, which is part of Ishwara's story. So you are part of Ishwara's story in this particular time and place. That's the prarabdha karma. And so as this prarabdha karma is taking place, there is also free will, which is also not outside of Ishwara. Mm-hmm. Like say if we were to say in this physical world, just the physical world that we can do science with, there are an infinity of laws that hold this world together. We go on discovering them, right? And so the laws are there and they're pervasive. So within those laws you can do things, but everything that you're doing is within, absolutely everything on every level, what you're doing is being done within those laws. And so you have free will, which you can exercise like a muscle, but the exercise of free will is taking place. The free will and the exercise of free will is all part of Ishwara.
So can we see this as a kind of like a cinema then, a living cinema that we're watching? And that this is a...
You can't see it like that. I mean, they even have, in Panchadashi, there's chapter 10 is on that, looking at not as a cinema, but as a play. Like if, you know, if you're a play and you're an actor in the play, right?
Yeah, it's a three-dimensional kind of thing,
yeah.
You know.
Swamiji even tells stories like that. Like, say, you're an actor, the difference between a jnani and an ajnani is the jnani realizes, you know, I'm acting this part in this play. And the ajnani is taking it for serious. The jnani realizes who I am and I'm playing this role, but without losing, playing the role, and playing the role really well, without losing sight of myself. But the ajnani is playing the role, not realizing that they're playing a role. There's no differentiation between yourself and the role.
Yeah, well, in this like three-dimensional cinema, it's so easy just to get lost. I mean, think that you're in it rather than watching it.
That's right. That's another. That's a totally different example, but that's a good example. Like if you're, like I don't like to go to scary movies. I don't like to be excited like that or made afraid. Yeah. But why should I be made afraid when I'm watching a movie?
Yeah, yeah, show me something I like.
Because it is Ishwara, you know, yeah. The whole thing.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, you're watching a scary movie, and that can you get pulled into it. Mm-hmm. Or watching this life, we get pulled into it.
Watch the news.
Get pulled into it. Yeah.
But does there become a point, do you think, when it's more like you're just kind of resting as Brahman that doesn't really do, and then the doing is more like Ishwara's doing.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, the jiva pops up. The jiva pops up every time, you know, where you want something to be a certain way.
Right.
Now, let me make that a little bit more clear. We can want things to be a certain way, because that's what we're doing, but your ananda is not at stake. So that's not, no problem there. That's all Ishwara. But as soon as you say, as soon as you have an investment, I need this so that I can be happy, that's where the jiva comes.
But isn't that Ishwara also making that mistake?
No, it's not Ishwara making that mistake. It's your personal ajnana making the mistake. Mm. But that ajnanam exists within Ishwara.
Yeah.
The personal ajnanam exists with. There isn't anything that doesn't exist within Ishwara. But Ishwara is not an ajnani. Mm-hmm. You know.
But the personal ajnanam is maybe
the individual's ajnanam.
Right. But it's more kind of, in some sense, less real, I would think, than Ishwara. Do you know what I mean? Kind of. I mean, it's like it's not really real in a way.
I'm just not following what you mean.
Well, what I mean is, it's such an illusion in a sense. That
but for who? It's not an illusion for the person who's suffering, right?
Right.
It is an illusion, but
yes. No. I mean, for the person who's suffering, they feel that's really real.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're identifying stronger than the one who is not suffering.
Absolutely.
That's the whole point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about if you, you know, when we use the meadow example?
Right.
it's all, say you have an imagination of a meadow. You're the Ishwara of the meadow because you're the whole meadow. You don't belong. The meadow comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you. You don't. The meadow's not away from you, but you're free of the meadow. That's your experience if you have a meadow imagination. But now imagine in the meadow that there's two characters in the meadow. There's a whole bunch of characters, but two in particular. One has ajnanam, doesn't realize who he is in reference to the whole meadow and to the self, doesn't know. The other one knows. That's totally different, right? One, both the jnani, the one who has knowledge, and the ajnani, the one that doesn't have knowledge, both are mitya, both are maya. It's not that the jnani is any more real than the ajnani, and it's not that the truth of the jnani is any different than the truth of the ajnani. They're both Brahman, you know. But one is suffering and the other isn't.
Yeah.
One knows the self and the truth of the whole thing and the other doesn't.
And for some reason that pain tends to seem to be real.
Pain hurts.
It gets your attention. It
definitely gets your attention. And you don't know how to get out of it. See, the ajnani in the meadow has no way out of that situation.
Yeah.
And then this is why they call it samsara chakra, because say in the meadow the ajnani dies. They're still not out because they go to a heavenly meadow and they reincarnate back into the meadow, you know? So they're still within, endlessly within that duality. Whereas the jnani in the meadow, what is the jnani recognizes is that I'm not the meadow, I'm not the person, or you can say I'm the entire meadow and I'm free of the entire meadow.
I guess what I meant, I was talking more about it, somebody who has knowledge but not vairagya. So like that jiva popping up, you know,
yeah,
is,
oh, I see what
that's
you mean.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, the jiva pops up, then you see that whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, you understand the whole thing. Yeah. And you can also be kind to that one who's popping up and just kind of pull it back. Yeah. One who says, who gets caught by the situation, you know, and then feels hurt or this mm-hmm. or that. You know, you can pull that person, that part back with your knowledge.
And that ajnanam yeah. that's popped up in that moment,
yeah,
it can go. It's not as
real. Or it can go like, oh, it's not
knowledge.
Real at all. No,
that's
it's not. Yeah, it can go just like
right.
that.
Pull back by knowledge, the identified jiva, right?
Yeah.
That bringing in the knowledge, knowing that that's not who I am, that's a body-mind complex?
Or, yeah, that too. But like say your mind, sometimes your mind is peaceful and very clear and your knowledge is shining brightly. You know, everything's fine. You know who you are, you know this is, you see this as Ishwara, it's all clear to you. And then something catches the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then the mind gets itself all entangled and, you know, hurt or angry or depressed or down, just all kinds of things happen, then your knowledge will bring that back, will bring that mind back.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by your knowledge?
Your self-knowledge. In other words, you know the whole process of what's going on. You know, you know what's happened to your mind. You know why it's got entangled like that. You know what's creating those emotions.
Yeah.
And so you have... Not a, you have various tools to calm that part of your mind back, all inner child work and all of that kind
right.
of stuff. But then you also have, you know, your knowledge that knows exactly what has happened to the mind, and you can bring your mind back to the real source of wholeness and
once
ananda.
When it's calm,
yeah.
it's calmed down, then naturally.
Yeah, and you can also just wait it out and it'll calm down and that will bring it back. But say you want to expedite mm-hmm. the journey home.
Expedite means what?
Bring it back more quickly.
Uh-huh.
Say you want to, you know, bring it, make this whole painful journey into samsara, where you'd like to get home a little bit more quickly.
Yeah.
You know, then you have different tools to do that.
Would you?
But if you don't use those tools and even bring your knowledge, you will come home anyway.
Right.
Right. It'll just take longer.
But would you say that that pain or that suffering is that's a reaction, right? And it's an unconscious reaction, or does it have to do with that?
It usually is an unconscious reaction. You know, it's an unconscious reaction that kind of clouds your knowledge or your understanding.
Mm.
That's very, very common. But there's also, I would say, these are where you have behaviors. Ways you behave in the world toward others, say, for instance, that cause you and others pain. Like the way that you've learned how to behave or how you've been socialized. Say you've been socialized in a way that causes you pain and others pain in the way you interact with them. And so that's a different type of learning where you slowly learn. It's called Kaushalam. Kaushalam means you just learn how to be appropriate in different situations.
Skills,
social skills. So you have to learn social skills also. Mm. And then, but that's kind of learning how to maneuver in the world, you know, in a way that works. Mm. So we develop these, you know, social skills, and even in jobs in the workplace, they have all kinds of books on how to manage difficult people. Or how to manage difficult situations. These are all social skills, so you have to learn those type of things, you know. And then there's inner child type of work, how to manage your own psyche, not the, you know. So those are skills that we learn. But then there's also, you know, the reality of who I really am,
mm-hmm.
and what this really is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what brings the mind back into its wholeness. In the end.
No.
So that's really clear what you made right now, the difference between the quick way through the tools and the inner child dialogue.
Yeah.
It's very beautiful, Radha.
Yeah.
Very, very beautiful. And then the slow way is to know the self.
Well, I didn't say exactly that, but there's some truth in that. Like, it's very important for us to know these inner skills of different ways of working with our unconscious. You know, just like, it's kind of like if you break your leg, we could let it heal naturally. That has a lot of problems. You break your leg and you just let's see how it heals itself. It's much better if you happen to know how to heal it or to be with somebody who knows how to do it, mm-hmm. to set it properly, you know. So I think with our unconscious and with our mind also, even in terms of cognitive psychology that has to do much more with just how we're relating to the world, mm-hmm. on a conscious level.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the inner child work and depth psychology, how to handle our unconscious. It's very important knowledge to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if we don't have that knowledge, then we don't really have the tools to in a more quick way, you know, or even at all, to take care of some of these unconscious problems that we have, unconscious complexes.
Yeah.
And if you do know how to work with them, then it is much more rapid and much more effective.
Yeah.
And if you don't know any of that, you know, then knowledge will help and a lot of prayer will help also, you know, but it's not as direct. In the end, you need knowledge to have that freedom.
But they seem to balance each other out. Because
we need both.
One goes too far in one direction, work at too much psychological stuff too much, right? Then all of a sudden, there's kind of a flatness that starts to happen. And then it's like, well, no, wait, do I want to keep doing that? Or what am I here for now?
You know? And I think there comes a time where both are always happening.
Mm.
Like the one isn't happening in the absence of the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be like saying like this. Say if you have knowledge, then you have knowledge. Your mind has knowledge and clarity, all of that. And at the same time, you're engaging with others and talking and handling this problem and that problem and doing this and doing that. It's happening at the same time. The one's not negating the other. And if something difficult comes up in the situation, then you're dealing with that, but it's yourself and your knowledge is there also.
And there's sort of a maturity that happens.
Yeah, yeah. And in the inner work also, it's the same thing. Your knowledge is there, you are there, the whole is there, and this little complex also is there that you're working with. Mm. But it's all there at the same time.
You once told a story about, I don't know what you call them exactly, but two sages were arguing about duality versus...
Oh, yeah, and one would...
And the tiger comes in and they run up a tree.
Yeah.
I think, isn't that relevant to this? I
mean, I think it's relevant. It's a little different, but that story is... Swamiji's told the story that, say in India, you know, there's sadhus that are living up in the Himalayas. And there's one Dwaitin, you know, dual is two, is comes to the ashram of a Dwaitin, non-dual. And they're having their talking and having a debate, you know, and arguing with each other. And they both brought their students and whatnot. And so they're having this serious debate. And a big tiger comes right into the arena there. And everybody gets up, including the Dwaitin, and scurries up the tree, you know. And so now the Advaitin is way up there in one tree and the dualist is up there in another tree. And so the dualist says to the Advaitin, if there's non-duality, how is it that you scurried up that tree? And the non-dualist says, you know, mitya tiger, mitya tree. Something like that.
Yeah.
So let's call it a night. I'm gonna meet with somebody now.